Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
So normally a bunch of people are in here. This is probably pretty crowded.
Yeah, on a busy day we can fit about 20 people, usually on average, in the elevator. Of course, you can see we have a great view out today. It takes 41 seconds in the elevator to go up all the way to the top.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, the host of Sound Effect, and this is BJ Listman, one of the elevator operators at the Space Needle, or as he sometimes refers to himself, a vertical transportation specialist.
Right now, we got a great view of Elliott Bay and Puget Sound. Mountains are out very nicely today. The Olympic Mountains, those are on the Washington State Peninsula. We get a lot of orca whales come into the bay, which is really cool to see.
This is a gorgeous day, by the way.
This is a really good day for it. We actually got Mount Rainier out today as well. So, and this is the top. It's a nice quick trip.
We head out onto the observation deck, 520 feet up in the air. This iconic Seattle landmark has enchanted BJ since he was a child.
It's kind of funny, actually. I have one of those 3-foot-tall paper Space Needle models. And the model kit had you glue the elevators in place, but I never did because I like to make them go up and down the Space Needle. So now the fact that I do that on the real Space Needle is kind of funny in an ironic sort of way. But I love it. It's great since I was a kid.
Do you still have the model?
I do still have the model. It's in my living room in my World's Fair collection because I collect a lot of Space Needle memorabilia.
Do you remember the first time when you actually came up here?
I do. It was my mom's 30th birthday in 1994, and we went to the restaurant, and I didn't know it rotated at the time, and it was at night, and so I was sitting there eating my little chicken tenders, you know, and I looked out the window and saw downtown. Well, then some time went by, and I looked out, and I saw nothing but darkness and water, and I thought the city had disappeared and sunk in the water, and I was freaking out, because I was worried, like, where did Seattle go? And then one of the servers came by and said, no, the restaurant's actually rotating. And I like squinted at the window like, oh yeah, I can actually see it move. And then I was fine. And that was my earliest Space Needle memory.
This city did not. It was just Lake Union.
Exactly. So it was fine.
As we walk around the observation deck, BJ points to a spot on the ground on Lower Queen Anne.
So just to the left of the parking garage, there's the parking lot. Then right across is my apartment. And I have an astronomy laser pointer. And I used to collaborate with a friend of mine who would work on the elevator, and we would do what we call Operation Tinkerbell, where I would be ready on my balcony with the laser pointer, and then he would be on the north-facing elevator and said, okay guys, we're going to start moving up, and if we clap our hands and wish really hard, we'll see Tinkerbell fly by, and then the elevator will move, and then I'll hit it with my green laser pointer, and they'll see green flashes going around, and it would freak them out. They'd be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. So we would time that perfectly from my apartment and the Space Needle.
Kids would probably really get a kick. They got a kick
out
of that.
Oh, they loved it. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. It's almost like a different world is happening at this level.
It's like it's a world up here, and then there's a world down there. We get to kind of look over it and see what's what, you know. Yeah. It's a good way to escape the hustle and bustle of the ground.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is up in the air. We'll hear about the glory days of commercial air travel. We'll hang out with some birds who just want to go home. And we'll learn about an organization that is trying to make the aerospace industry more diverse. BJ, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's been awesome.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, this is so beautiful.
We drew it on this napkin. Sensation of the year, a symbol for today, Space Needle USA, 608 feet high, my friends.
The view from the top of the Space Needle on a clear day is pretty hard to beat. Another place up in the air where you can see how big the world is and how small we are is from the cockpit of an airplane. According to the Black Pilots of America Association, most of the people who get to do this are white. The organization says that less than 2% of pilots in the United States are African American. Our next guest here on Sound Effect wants to change this. His name is Jesse Hayes. He's a Boeing engineer, and he's the president of the Red-Tailed Hawks Flying Club. It's based in Mukilteo. The mission of Red-Tailed Hawks is to get kids of color interested in flight and the aerospace industry. Jesse started the club back in 2013. Today, Red-Tailed Hawks has about 50 members, from middle schoolers to young men and women who are about to graduate from high school. Jesse's love of flying began when he was very young, growing up in Texas. Yes, his family had a car, but they also had an airplane, which Jesse's father adored.
He was a doctor, but he never talked doctor stuff at home. He came home and talked about airplanes. So I was pretty much raised in the back of an airplane.
So why didn't he become a pilot? Why did he become a doctor instead?
So when he was in school, he was told at the time by his counselors that he would not be hired as an engineer. Him being a black person, the best way to use his talents would probably be a doctor, because at that time it was socially acceptable for black folks to help out medically other black people. But the truth of the matter was, at that time, airlines were not hiring black pilots, period.
So you were raised in the back of an airplane. What kind of airplane did your dad have?
The first one was a Mooney.
And you guys went on trips?
All the time. We would fly from Texas to go visit family up in Gary, Indiana. And the primary reason he started flying was that he got tired of having trouble driving through some of the southern states. You know, not having a hotel to stay in, not being able to get gasoline. And so we could fly over all of that racism at the time.
Literally, yeah.
And you know, get to where we were going.
Were you aware when you were a kid that you guys were bypassing all of that ugliness below?
To some extent, but honestly, my dad worked really hard to shelter us. I remember in high school challenging my dad while he was involved in so many organizations that were for black people only, you know. And I didn't get it. He goes, well, that's because you haven't been told that you can't do something just because you're black. And it really wasn't until my early experiences in the Air Force when I understood where he was coming from. There were no black officers on the review board. There were no black commanders on the base or whatever. So there was nobody advocating for me. You know, in my pilot training class, every black person in our class got washed out. We were all Air Force Academy grads, so you know, we were all very sharp individuals. But when it came time to right-size the classes, we were the first ones to go.
And when you say washed out in the Air Force Academy, you mean kicked out? So
washed out is a term that we use in the Air Force pilot training when someone is removed from training. And all it takes is three unsatisfactories in a row. So if you show up on Monday and you have an unsatisfactory landing, and you show up on Tuesday and you have an unsatisfactory loop, on Wednesday you have an unsatisfactory takeoff, then you go straight to a flight review board and your fate is determined. So in the case of my class, we're all told to go do something else for the Air Force. Now, I went on to become a navigator and had a great career, but I was not given the opportunity to do what is considered the most prestigious job, right?
Which is?
Being a pilot. And in particular, being a fighter pilot, right? You know, there's a hierarchy. But that was the reality. There's no way other than to explain it as just institutional bias and the lack of a support system. You know, even the Tuskegee Airmen after World War II, they couldn't get jobs as pilots with airlines. They wound up, you know, doing other things. You know,
that's amazing. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That they tried to get jobs and couldn't.
No. Folks know intellectually that, you know, black folks can fly and do things just as well as anyone else. But quite frankly, too often we're either shut out or left out of the industry, right? And the only way you can build up the support system is to have more folks in the industry that look like us, and someone to advocate, someone to mentor, someone to coach.
So when you have a student who goes through the Red-Tailed Hawks program, I imagine you're starting to see the payoff because it's been around for a few years now.
Yeah.
So
you have kids who go through all this instruction and training, and if they don't go into being pilots,
right.
Do you feel like you have failed them somehow?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, actually getting a pilot or two out of the deal, we just consider bonus. You know, we really are about just using aviation to expose the kids to practical applications of the STEM that they're learning in school. And we firmly believe that pilot knowledge will make them better at no matter what they choose to do in life.
Well, give some examples.
So I was talking to a couple of girls yesterday who want to go into the medical field. And as a pilot, you have to understand the physiology of your body. You have to understand how your vision is modified by night and day. You need to understand what pressure does to your ability to think and react. That knowledge of physiology will help them, you know, as they make their choices towards their pre-med education and whatnot.
So medicine,
yeah. You know, lawyers, you know, kid wants to be a lawyer. We expose them to the governance of federal regulations, right? And so they understand the laws that surround aviation. Right?
I'm sure
and
that, so that book is thick. Yeah.
Very thick. And so they get appreciation for, you know, what it takes and how the laws are applied.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, want to be an engineer, you know, we're right there with them, right? Because in order to fly an airplane, you have to understand how the airplane is built. You need to understand the systems and how they operate. Not only just to be able to function on an ordinary day, but how to react when things break, right? If you lose a system, you need to know how that affects your ability to get to where you're trying to go or to land.
From where you're sitting right now, how long do you think a program like this will be needed?
For a very long time. You know, we're doing what we can to fight the right fight, to make sure that folks know that the opportunities are there. But the big battlefield is really, you know, in the boardrooms and in the HR departments of the companies that are doing the hiring, to take the time to actually identify folks who are qualified rather than defaulting to say that you can't find anyone who's qualified when in fact no real effort has been made to go out and look.
That was Jesse Hayes, president of the Red-Tailed Hawks Flying Club. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is up in the air. And right now I am standing in a gravel parking lot at the Grant County International Airport. It's just outside of Moses Lake. And some University of Washington students are here with their professor, Robert Wingley. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences at the university. And they are in the process of trying to launch what is essentially a 20-foot-long glider. It only weighs about 12 pounds, and it is carrying a small propulsion system. Really, it's about the size of a baseball mitt. And a large balloon is being filled with helium, and that balloon is going to pull this glider and the contraption attached to it and pull it up into the atmosphere, into the upper reaches of the Earth's atmosphere. And if this works, this is the first step in what researchers hope will eventually be possible, which is to have satellites that are stationary in the Earth's atmosphere that can keep an eye on one location, satellites that don't move from their spot, satellites that are powered by solar energy, and they can stay up there indefinitely. So let's talk to Robert Wingley to find out what all of this means and how it could possibly affect your life and mine in the future.
If you actually develop the technology properly, you could develop it so that it just flies around a circle over a particular patch of the Earth, and that's one of the holy grails.
And the satellites that we see on a clear night, on a starry sky, it looks like a star traveling across the dark sky. None of those go in little circles, do they? They all travel.
They all travel. So the ones that you see are what's called in low Earth orbit, and they have a 90-minute orbit around the Earth, so it's the same as a space station, so it's about 90 minutes. So if you're going to watch a patch, then you end up taking photos of it every 90 minutes, and then it moves off to different areas, so it's hard to look at that patch of the Earth. We have geosynchronous satellites that have an orbit that matches the Earth's rotation so that you see a single patch of the Earth all the time, but you're way far away from the Earth, so you don't have the resolution. And then the cost of putting something up there, it's like $10,000 a pound. And once it's up there, and you don't get to change it. So what we're trying to do is develop technology that you could do it routinely, monitor it, could help you do the internet, whatever. And then if you need to update it, you could bring it down, cheap, reload, send it back up. So the whole experiment here that you're going to see today is going to cost us less than $1,000.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So theoretically, when something like this actually comes to fruition and becomes mainstream, potentially you could own one of these personally because the cost seems so cheap, and you could monitor your own piece of property from space.
From the edge of space. Yes.
And it would have. And what would the resolution be like?
It depends on what kind of. It could be really high resolution. I mean, some people don't like having high resolution pointing down at them, but there are restrictions and requirements for it.
What other applications? I'm thinking, spying, monitoring war and disaster areas. Yeah. What other?
It's really for remote sensing and however you want to use remote sensing. And I should say that this effort here is actually sponsored by Amazon Catalyst. That working through the University of Washington.
But remote sensing, what possibilities, this is your world, what possibilities do you see? What menu? The menu I see is probably limited compared to the one that you see in terms of applications.
Okay, so there's two things. Communications is one of my pet things, and I've been working with students in rural areas, and communications is actually not as great as they claim it is. So when you see those pictures of the great coverage that this telephone company providing, if you actually stopped and still framed it, you'd see huge gaps across the rural areas of US that aren't really covered by these phone networks. And if you go to the foreign nations, it's a lot worse than that. So trying to solve that communications and bringing everybody up to the same kind of technological era is a pet ambition of mine. From the remote sensing, there are huge applications. So we're in a very tumultuous political time, but global warming is happening. I'm actually going to use the word not just global change, but global warming. You see the glaciers retreating. These things could be used to really monitor and quantify exactly what's going on at a really high resolution than we presently have. And so you can actually see the devastation that's occurring presently. So they're the two pet things that I'd like to see happen.
What are the nefarious uses of this?
Well, the nefarious, of course, is the military applications, and I'm not going to go that way. Okay, we're just a bunch of scientists, and how you guys use it.
Yeah. By the time everything is ready to launch, the UW students have spent more than 2 hours in this parking lot working at a table, piecing the glider and its payload together. And now that it's time to lift this thing into the air, another teacher shouts out some helpful advice.
If things go horribly wrong, be ready to get out of the way or take cover. Do not try to help by grabbing anything. Just get out of the way.
The huge balloon lifts the glider up into the sky. It takes 2 tries, but it finally works.
Dumble. So that's our launch.
So it's a success.
Yeah, it's off in the air.
What Robert and his students are really testing today is whether the propulsion system attached to the glider will work. Nothing like it exists. This is what could make a stationary satellite possible. It's the super lightweight plastic contraption the size of a baseball mitt that sits on the glider where a small cockpit would be. UW grad student Paige Northway says more than 100 batteries the size of pennies will be the power supply. The hope is the batteries will generate hundreds of sparks that will pulse the glider forward.
So we have energy stored on the batteries. We transfer that energy to a set of capacitors, which has like a just a controlled spot for that energy to be stored, and then we short that energy through the air. So it's like you shuffle your feet along the carpet and shock someone. That's essentially what's happening, but it's happening with a lot of energy instead of a little static energy.
Yeah.
And so that's how it works.
And it's that energy that will make it turn around in a circle, hopefully.
So that
below.
Energy pushes the air out, and that air pushing the thing forward is what causes, with the design of the plane, will cause it to go around in a circle.
Yeah. And there it is. Look at that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's cool. Nice.
It's beautiful. Awesome. It's just sitting above a big white series of clouds.
Are you guys going to put your
It's going up.
In the end, the glider stayed up for about an hour before falling back down to Earth, which was the plan. But unfortunately, it landed in a very remote area along the Snake River. Robert and his students are going to try and recover it next week and are anxious to review the data. Robert says that the basic science of what he and his students do is pretty well known, but when you're trying to do something brand new like this, bits of knowledge are like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. It's easy to identify what individual pieces look like, but it's a real skill set to be able to put one puzzle piece together with another piece to make something that's completely unique and useful. He says when that happens, you create something that is quite spectacular. This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is up in the air. So far today, we've taken some pretty literal looks from up in the air. But up in the air can also mean that you don't know what's going to happen next, because the forces are beyond your control. Rising rental prices in the Puget Sound region can be difficult enough for those of us who've been here a while. But what if you're a refugee? Everything is completely new. The weather, the language, the food. And on top of all of that, this extremely tough housing market. It's almost impossible to build a new life without reliable shelter. There's a man in SeaTac who started an organization to help refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo find housing. In this story, he shares some moments from a typical day in his life.
Allô, Papa Roger, je sais que vous avez besoin de moi, n'est-ce pas?
The phone's all over.
I don't know how often people call me.
Hello.
There are people looking for, like, jobs, people having evictions. The Congolese refugee community, we are still feeling the stress of the refugee camp while in resettlement. Okay, merci beaucoup. Yeah, bye. My name is Floribert Mubalama. I'm 36 years old. I'm from the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I've been resettled. So now I'm in America since 2014, December. So we are not refugees because we left our country and come to America. No, we are refugees because we don't have a home, and we are countryless, we are stateless, and we are homeless. Now, being in that situation, when we are resettled, the first things we expect is a home to stay. I see my wife want to add something.
We was six in one bedroom, and we were so tight.
It was not easy for a refugee to live or to find a three-bedroom apartment. Anyway, most of the landlord, they don't trust you. Where are you coming from? No credit. They know that the assistance for refugees in this area is only 3 months. After 3 months, the agency have to step out. When I saw that now I will start paying by myself, I look at my income. I say, I need to move. We did our best, and I live in a three-bedroom apartment, which is a big difference. It's not easy. It's not easy. So I'm seeing people every day crying, oh, can you help us? Myself, I'm struggling, guys. So people are not stable. We are like nomad, and that is due to rent. If they increase the rent, decision are made in the family. You have to go find a cheaper place. For example, the people who live in Kent at the Bonacassa apartment, the landlord increased their rent by $200 by June. So people are just, where are we going? It used to be a low-income place to live, but with the change that is coming, I'm seeing most of them thinking of ways to move. So we have arrived at Bonacassa. Odi, ulikuja hapa mwaka gani tena?
Paka nyinyi ndio wenyewe najua
kama. Yulina Bilombele, that's her name. She invited us because she got evicted. So it's something which is, she doesn't understand, she don't know what is going on. This is from the Superior Court, King County, Washington. They said defendant failed to pay the rent and have further failed to vacate and surrender the premises. I don't have the money to give them. The money they're asking for, I don't have it. So the case, myself, I'm afraid because she will come again to my house before she finds a shelter. That's why I'm very much concerned about this. Yeah, it's like you are born again in another country. So you expect a lot of things to be done, which is difficult to get.
That story was produced by Isabel Vasquez. She's a fellow in NPR's Next Generation Radio. Vasquez reported the story in a journalism training project in Seattle. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And for this next story, let me introduce you to Gloria Cifera.
We're in South Seattle on a horse farm overlooking Lake Washington and above Boeing Field, so we get lots of airplanes flying over here.
I've had the pleasure of knowing Gloria since my daughter started riding one of her ponies on this farm a few years ago. And no matter how deep the mud is in the winter and spring or how dusty it is in the summer, Gloria will appear in her white Jeep to check in on her horses or take dirty horse blankets to the laundromat. Her salt and pepper hair is usually done just so. She wears lipstick that's always some shade of pink. Her clothes will be clean and stylish because she's usually headed out somewhere, and she'll often be wearing white shoes. Gloria is 79 years old. She's a mother, a doting grandmother, and a skilled horsewoman. She once rounded a barrel so low and fast on her horse that she broke her foot. But there was a time when Gloria's work took her around the world to exotic locales. From 1962 to 1964, Gloria was a Pan American flight attendant. She didn't really know what she was walking into when she applied for the job with a friend.
I was through college, and I had a girlfriend that flew for Pan American, and she said, they're going to be interviewing at Seattle. You should come down and interview. So I did, and I was horrified because they had like 7 openings, and they had 300 girls apply for each opening. There was a French girl who was with her mother speaking French in her mink stole. Then there were girls in Birkenstocks with 14 strands of beads around their necks that looked like hippies, and then there were some that just looked like ordinary citizens, and some glamour girls, and some not-so-glamour girls.
And what were you?
I was in the middle. I was just a person that applied and was horrified when I got hired because I was too short. They'd have a height requirement, and I was like 2 inches too short. And in my class was a girl from Italy named Gabriella, and she was over 6 feet tall, so she was way over height. But they picked, I think, your personality.
What, do you remember what the interview was like?
Yes, they had me walk up and down walk up and down so they could see how I walked and that I didn't stomp along.
How old were you?
I was 24, and I was older when I was hired because they had a lot of girls that were like 19 and 20. And they sent us to New York to be trained. And in order to get to New York cheaply on Pan American, they flew us via London, over the polar route to London, and then we got a flight back to New York.
And could you explain the allure, why someone would want to compete with other women to get one of these jobs?
Because they fly internationally, they had health insurance, they paid you very well, you had lots of days off because you flew lots of days. And they had wonderful routes. And when you went to a layover, you did not stay at the Motel 6. You stayed at the Royal Hawaiian on Waikiki Beach, or you stayed at the Ilokai. You stayed someplace really nice. And they would have someone come and get your uniform and dry clean it for you when you were on your layover. And layovers were anywhere from short to maybe a week. And all expenses paid. And flying was different in those days. So people, this would be in the 1960s, so people would dress up to take a flight. They wouldn't come in their bedroom slippers and their pajamas with their hair in curlers. And first class people were very, very polished and lovely. And the economy people were just as nice. And our food was delicious. And our service was fabulous. And I really mean fabulous, because we were on our feet the entire flight saying, can I get you a pillow? Would you like a glass of water? And we would walk the aisles and we'd take turns walking the aisles. So there was always some stewardess close by. And in first class, we had linen tablecloths for each tray table. We had real crystal, stem crystalware. We had real china. We had real silver with Pan American's emblem on it. And all the meals were cooked from scratch. So if they were having prime rib, we got a raw prime rib on the plane and started cooking it when the engines were on.
What were some of the people like who you met on these trips?
Well, I met a very weird man and his wife, who was very dowdy. They were from Britain, and she wore skirts down to almost her ankles with orthopedic walking shoes, and she was very dowdy, and he was very overbearing, and he did not want to carry his briefcase onto the plane. This was in Fiji, so he had an East Indian employee with a turban take his briefcase and put it on the plane. Then I walked around and said, would anyone care for a drink, because they were free for first-class passengers, and he said, I want to eat now. And I said, we have an entire economy section with lots of children, and we're going to do the economy meal service first and your bar service now. And he punched me in the shoulder and sent me careening backwards and hit the bulkhead. And he was absolutely a boob. So, of course, I had taken his liquor drink, but he did not get a drink. I did not serve him anything. And then when I was walking out of first class, a man grabbed my arm and pulled me down in the seat next to him. And he said, I am the ambassador to the United States from New Zealand, and I'm going to write a good letter about you, and I'd like to buy you a hat because you're put up with so much.
Did you get a hat?
We were not allowed to accept tips, but I appreciated the offer of buying a hat.
What kind of adventures did you have when you were with your fellow stewardesses, say when you were in Hawaii or London or some location like that?
I didn't have a lot of interaction because those girls wanted to do a shop. Mm. And I would read ahead on someplace I was going if I'd never been there before, and then I'd take a tour and see the historical sites and this kind of thing. And but they always had a crew party. Always had crew parties. The minute you'd get in, you'd have a crew party.
Okay. So a crew party was a big dinner?
No, a crew party was go to the captain's room or the somebody's room, because you each had your own room, private room, and drink. And I don't drink, so I never had a drink. But everybody else was drinking. And when I was in Bangkok, I was somebody in the operating crew said, I'm going to fix you a drink, and I think you're going to like it, because I know you don't drink. And it was a gin and tonic. And that was the first time I ever had liquor, and I was like 25 years old.
Did you like a gin and tonic?
I did. I loved them. And then my other lady friend introduced me to the margarita. So I only have two drinks that I'll drink, and I won't drink anything else. I think the rest of it smells awful. Who'd want to drink it?
So even today, even a margarita. Today,
today I have not tasted bourbon. I have never tasted scotch.
Why did you end your service as a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get married, and they did allow you to get married. They had just changed the rule. But I wanted instant baby, so I quit my job. I wasn't aware that it was a golden time of flying until afterwards, when the golden time was gone.
That's Gloria Safara talking about her time as a flight attendant for Pan American Airlines in the early 1960s.
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And for the last story in our show today, we are going to meet a man who I first spotted driving south on I-5 near Federal Way in his very eye-catching truck. His name is Michael McAndrews. And on the day we meet in person for the first time, he's kneeling down in a blacktop parking lot in downtown Burien, talking to four white wicker baskets.
You guys want to fly? You guys want to fly? Yep, we're talking, yes. Get ready to fly. Do you want to fly?
Inside these baskets are Michael's homing doves, a fancier variety of a homing pigeon.
Oh, yeah. They want to go.
He adores these birds. Almost all of Michael's birds are white, and they're also the heart of his business called White Dove Release. People hire Michael to come to their events, usually funerals, where he'll send off a flock of white doves in dramatic fashion. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Today is a training run for 50 of the younger, less experienced doves, ones that haven't flown before.
You want to do it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
All right, we're grabbing the baskets here.
You'll
the lids.
Do that one there.
I'll do this one.
I'll
okay.
I'll do this one here.
And we're all going to do it at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh boy.
One, two, three. Let's go. Let's fly. Oh my gosh, and they're off! Look at them!
The doves immediately form a group and begin moving as one unit. They fly above parked cars, apartment buildings, and LA Fitness, and then in this white swirl in the sky, they head north, back to their home in Michael's backyard.
They'll gradually start to get it. Oh, that's pretty, isn't it?
They're beautiful.
I'm going to load these up.
Yeah. What is the science happening right now where they are able to know where they are on a map and where to fly once you lift the lid?
The strongest theory that scientists have is the magnetic field in the Earth. It's like that compass. They have a chemical in their brain or in their head called magnetite, and they think that that has something to do with it. There have been other theories, smell, sound, the position of the sun. Those are all possibilities. But in Washington, we don't always see the sun. And it's just a gray, cloudy day. They still fly home.
All right. Should we head back?
We hop into Michael's souped-up truck. It has 22-inch chrome wheels and pearlescent flames painted on the front. We drive about 3 miles back to his house, just north of downtown Burien, and we take neighborhood streets going around 25 to 40 miles an hour. We weren't in the car for more than 6 minutes, and we are not the first to reach the house.
You want to set your coat down anywhere?
Sure.
Your bags, whatever. Yeah. Well, they're home already.
Three of the birds beat us back.
How is that possible? They're home?
Right there on the loft. These three here that came in ahead, at least we know of three because we saw them, just felt the pace was too slow. They already had it figured out, and they didn't need to dilly-dally around.
Doves can fly 50 miles an hour and can easily travel 100 miles in one day. The three speedy doves are perched outside what can only be described as a fancy bird condo. It's called a loft, There are two of them, and they look like large garden sheds cut down the middle. One wall is made of chicken wire, exposing the multiple cubbies inside where dozens of white doves sit on nests. Others rest on poles, and they're eating and flying around. Some openings at the top look like cat doors. A dove can enter the loft through these holes, but they can't leave to go outside. This is how Michael knows that these three birds were in the training flight that we just returned from. But the larger group of doves we released, they're still out there. Michael cups a hand over his brows on the sunny day and scans the sky.
Where are they?
Man, this is like waiting for your kids to come home.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're teenagers and they got the car for the first time.
There's a big group out there somewhere.
Michael fell in love with birds when he was a child, around 8 years old, after reading a National Geographic article called
The Flying Telegraph. It was all about homing pigeons in the war.
World War I. Michael wells up with tears when he talks about one pigeon from that time. Its name was Cheremie.
This bird was with a battalion of army of American soldiers, and they had crossed into German territory, and our artillery was bombing them.
So it was friendly fire.
Correct. Okay. And they'd sent out various homing pigeons carrying a message, stop the bombing, and the Germans would shoot the birds down. But they had one bird left, and it was Cheremie. And
okay.
So they released that bird, and the Germans shot its leg off and put a hole through its breast, and it still flew home carrying the message. And it saved the lost battalion, saved hundreds of lives.
Michael had lots of birds growing up. His nickname in high school was Bird Brain, and he says it wasn't an insult. It was just because birds were all that he ever thought about. For most of his adult life, he made a living as a photographer. His business releasing doves at events, it's a second career. When Michael first started, he thought that he would be doing a lot of weddings. But it turns out that where people really want to see these white, beautiful birds reach into the sky is when they're burying their dead.
When I first got into this, I didn't want to do funerals and memorials because I thought it was too emotional. I just didn't want to be around all the sadness. And a friend wanted me to do a funeral service for his friend. I did it. And people loved it. Tears in their eyes. And they're just oohs and ahs and clapping. And I thought, unreal, you know. Then I just started doing more. And I started to see how it helped the people with the healing and the closure. And it was just an honor for me to be there at a time which could possibly be one of the saddest days in their lives. It's just a thrill for me to do that.
At these gatherings, before Michael releases a large group of his doves, he'll send up one bird into the sky first.
I have one dove in a white heart-shaped wicker basket with flowers on it. And that dove we call a spirit bird. And it symbolizes the person we've come to honor taking their final journey. So I take the spirit bird out of the basket, and I hold it up, and I explain to everybody the symbolism. And then I hand it to the family member, or a family member, and they hold the dove. And just seeing how they hold it, and just caressing it, and kissing the dove, and giving it hugs, and then at when it's the right time, when they feel comfortable with it, they open their hands and set them free. And it's like releasing their spirit. And it's very moving, very moving.
Back outside, the rest of the doves that we've been waiting for are back. They're swirling in the sky as one unit, almost like a school of fish in a bait ball. With each loop, they get lower and lower until they land on the roof of one of the lofts.
Come on, guys. Come on. Come on. Come on.
Oh, yep.
A couple stragglers.
Yep.
Those are the ones that were off to the side, you know. They're so pretty against the blue sky.
Re- relieved that his babies are back safe and sound, Michael lights up and asks if I would like to see a newly hatched chick. We slip into one of the bird lofts.
Oh my gosh! Oh, it's a little tiny.
This just hatched about yesterday.
Whoa. It's not the cutest thing. It's, but
oh, I think it's beautiful. These are my babies.
Oh.
Cute little thing.
Little tiny.
And look at his little toes.
Yeah.
Oh, it just brings tears to my eyes. Can you?
How would you describe a baby dove?
Well, just a little bundle of helplessness. It's totally helpless. If it weren't for their parents, they wouldn't make it.
Yeah. Are its eyes even open yet?
No, not yet.
Michael says that his birds and the work that they do together has gotten him thinking more about his own death, his own mortality.
I wouldn't want to be forgotten.
Of all of the funerals and services Michael has been to, there is one that he might want to repeat when it's his time. The man being laid to rest was also into homing pigeons. His family made an unusual request. They asked if they could put some of their loved one's ashes in a capsule and attach it to the leg of one of Michael's birds. In death, this man finally got to fly up in the air with the creatures that he had always loved and cared for from the ground. That does it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. Help this week comes from Isabel Vasquez and Phyllis Fletcher. Dave Nagaris helps with online. Parker Miles Blom does photos and videos for the show. And Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. If you missed part of the show or any other episode of Sound Effect, you can catch up by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, where you can get all 107 episodes that we've aired so far. And you can also rate and review the show there, which is a really big help to us. You can also hear our stories on the NPR One app and see photos, videos, and other extras on our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. And we would love to hear from you, whether it's a story idea or some feedback on the show. Email us at soundeffect@knkx.org. We will be back next week, same time, same place, when Sound Effect heads into the woods.
There's the sound of the spring. There's the way that the performance space just naturally flows into an old growth forest that is the epitome of what I think of as the Pacific Northwest. And so anybody that comes here to see a show, that's the thing that blows everybody away. That, wow, I really didn't expect it to be so part of nature.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.